Welcome to Cardicast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. My name is Nick McGrath. To find out more about New Cardigan, a not-for-profit organisation, visit our website, newcardigan.org. And I'd just like to introduce Nick Henderson, who is a sound curator at the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia. And he's also a volunteer curator and archivist at the Australian Queer Archives. So welcome, Nick. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I just thought it's so funny that I just realized, you know, two Nicks in one podcast. This is a good way to start. Just wanted to ask a starting question, maybe to open things, you know, a conversation up. Just wanted to ask you, what does a sound curator do?
Sure. Look, I'm no longer a sound curator.
Sorry, Nick.
It's okay. We had a reorganisation at the National Film and Sound Archive, as I think, in fact, many cultural orgs are going through the same process or have done over the last couple of years, which is moving away from format or subject-based specialisations and moving into more generalist roles. So my role is as a curator within the creative team. And what that means at the National Film and Sound Archive is that I look after acquisitions generally from individuals or small groups, so bands or composers, collectors, offers from the public, you know, could be anything from home movies through to, you know, jazz records, cylinders, you name it. It's everything that we look after. So we kind of split most of our, I guess, curatorial roles from the acquisition side into two teams. So one's for what we call industry and the other one's creative. So one's more larger scale broadcasters and smaller is what I look after.
Oh, that's really interesting. So, yeah, I have heard that a lot of cultural institutions are sort of restructuring the way they do things and sort of moving away from like the expert kind of model where, you know, there's a curator that looks after a collection and becomes an expert in that collection or is an expert that comes into it from that point of view. I don't know if is it something you want to talk? I mean, it's difficult to talk about sometimes when you're working for an organisation to be really candid on, you know, on a podcast. Yeah. But
look, speaking purely as an individual and in no way to be construed as being speaking on behalf of my organisation, I'm sure our media team would prefer it that way. You know, look, I'm not convinced, and I think most institutions who have gone through this process are looking at others. They're looking at ways to be more efficient. They're looking at ways to broaden skill bases. What these sort of responses are generally looking to do is to respond to the situation of having less staff and being asked to do more. But you can't just keep on doing more and more with less and less staff, and it doesn't fundamentally provide often the continuity around collections in terms of the sorts of relationship management over longer periods of time. And really, you know, I think there's a number of gaps in the model, and that only really works if that you already have additional time to provide that sort of shadowing, training, support, and the sorts of, I guess, flexible project models that people, you know, talk about from an organisational design sense, but which don't often work so well in practice. And I think most institutions don't go through review processes. They're, you know, often very good talking about where they want to get to, but don't reflect on where they've been. Many institutions having that kind of cultural corporate knowledge, they don't often apply that very well. So,
yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I have to agree with what you're saying. I feel like, you know, especially in a curator, thinking of a curator, any curator type role in a cultural institution, that, you know, curators work for years to gain expertise in their collection and then to, you know, so that they can answer those really tough and intricate questions that the public asks us, you know, on a daily basis. You need to have that expertise to be able to respond rather than, this is my opinion, I'm sort of speaking from just generally, you know, if you take the experts away from their collection and sort of try and make their roles a bit more general, you know, you'll never get on top of your inquiries that you receive from the, you know, members of the public, because you wouldn't be able to answer a lot of those really difficult questions about a collection that really require the knowledge and the years of work and expertise that, you know, allows you to answer those questions. So,
Absolutely.
I mean, that's fundamental to me. So I'm sure our listeners who are probably, you know, preaching to the converted here, but I hope that doesn't become a trend that just sort of, well, it'll be interesting to see how the glam sector sort of progresses in the time, you know, in the next few years, But I guess that leads me on kind of to another question. You know, we can't ignore the fact that we're, you know, living through a pandemic right now. And I'm interested to know how this has changed your job working from home. How are you tackling it at the National Film and Sound Archive?
Look, it's been really interesting. I work in our Melbourne office. And so we have a team currently of 6 staff. We have 3 offices, but the bulk of our staff are in Canberra. So even in the kind of existing model, we're still remote from our collection store, principal collection store. So a lot of the sorts of aspects of what we did sort of fitted into this new model in a sense. But still, there are a lot of limitations. And I think for any collecting institution, working from home presents significant issues. Having to put collection offers off or look at ways to address collection pickups and change approaches to those if it needs to be done urgently in this current situation. Thankfully, we are able to have over the period of time, because Canberra hasn't had the lockdowns until very recently, we've been able to, I guess, work with our Canberra colleagues to directly transfer collections there and to manage things to some extent remotely without being able to go up and work on those collections. And more recently, even in the context of the lockdown, we've been able to have some skeleton staff to ensure that we're still keeping our work going. Many of us, we've ramped up, I guess, the digital side. And, you know, a lot of our work does involve digital acquisitions. That does present various issues. I think for us, just because of the size of the files, particularly for preservation audiovisual material, we're talking about file sizes which don't work well on home systems and home networks. Just, you know, if you're wanting to bring a feature film in, you're often talking about over terabyte sort of file for the prez copy, and then often there'll be a whole range of additional materials. So looking at multiple pathways that can work for people providing that content. So one of the areas that I look at is deliverables. And so for us, within funding arrangements for Film Australia or the state funding, film funding agencies, one of the requirements of that funding and the final funding payment is that creatives provide their content and a whole range of particular content, master material for the footage, whether it's a web series or feature film or documentary, as well as additional supplementary and supporting material. And the volume of that material often requires some really interesting processing and management in this environment. And you know, we've had to roll out different sorts of software upgrades, virtual acquisition stations and other things that allow us to process remotely. But it's been tricky over that time. And thankfully, we have a really great and experienced team that I get the chance to work with. So it's been a good process.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's good to hear that, like, there's been struggles and challenges, but you've been able to sort of find ways to overcome some of those, which is, you know, I think everyone's sort of being creative in the way we're working at the moment. And like, I relate to what you're talking about. When you work with a physical collection, it is difficult to be away from it, working at home when you're used to being in the collection store, you're working, you know, with people and objects often.
Also, I think for a lot of people, the reason they go into the glam sector is a connection with the materiality of the gallery or the museum, and moving away from that and the connections that either you make as a worker and the connections that you can provide between the object and the public are really important.
Yeah. Definitely. I was actually going to ask how your work with the Australian Queer Archives has been, you know, has it been really impacted? Because I know that a lot of that work was in a physical space. So have you been able to continue on with some digital projects during this lockdown period?
Yeah, look, quite a few. I've also, because we have slightly different arrangements, I guess, with the Queer Archives, I've been able to both pick up and process some material at home. So I still deal with some of the physical aspects. But, yeah, look, there's been a whole range of things. So I look after, for example, volunteers. And although the bulk of our volunteers were on site, we have a group who do online volunteering, particularly audio or oral history transcription, a little bit of program summaries and some digitized correspondence transcription. So that has still kind of continued to a lesser extent. And there's also, you know, there's still research going on and being able to provide reference and research support, exhibition loans and other things that we can do in particular ways. So, you know, one project I was helping with was some material for the National Portrait Gallery for an exhibition they had called Love Stories.
Oh, yeah, I saw that online. It looked amazing.
Yeah, so that was really fantastic for us to still be able to provide material from the collection that we had already digitised that could be loaned, printed and included both in online and physical exhibitions.
And you've had the centre and the reading room was opened. Was that open this year? Is that right, the new centre? Yeah.
The building was only opened a couple of months ago. I think we had all of about 2 weeks in between opening and the fifth and sixth lockdown, maybe. Who knows?
After I lost track too.
Have been open, albeit in our space, which is close to but not fully finished. So that was really wonderful after, I guess, 5 years of construction and building to finally get into our space.
And how has the sort of the changing of the archive's name kind of, have you got some really good feedback about that? Or I know it was a long process talking to your community and your members and things like that. How has it been received, do you think?
Oh, look, I think generally it's been received quite well. I think that even for some people, it has been something they disagreed with. And that was a small proportion of our membership as well as the broader community. Overwhelmingly, people were supportive through the two-year process that we undertook to change our name from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives to Australian Queer Archives. You know, we got some pushback early on after the change became something online, just in terms of our social media presence. And I think a lot of people who did that weren't involved in the organisation either as a member or a volunteer and were critiquing it from a position of not being familiar with the process. So, you know, I think I just tried, because I also manage our Facebook, tried to be very on top of and very take my time to explain the full background. I think people came around to that. You know, obviously social media spaces aren't always the most, they don't provide the opportunity for that sort of interpersonal engagement in them, but I think that, you know, taking the time to batter them with the process kind of got them on side to some extent.
Oh, that's good to hear. I know I do love to see your posts on Facebook and things. It's always good to see. Maybe that's one positive I've been taking out of the last maybe 18 months is just, you know, even though we've been stuck at home and a lot of that time, especially in Melbourne, you know, it was our 200th day in lockdown, I think it was yesterday. One thing I'm really enjoying is seeing that GLAM institutions are more and more opening up their back of house sort of, you know, processes. They're sharing their collections more online digitally. You're seeing videos of like, what, you know, different curators, different experts within the organisation working in different areas. I think it sort of feels to me like a digital awakening for the GLAM institution. It's taken a long time. It's probably been a very lengthy process over many years, but it feels like, you know, I think people are more on board with sharing online. Do you take that as a big positive out of the last, say, 12 months to 18 months?
Yeah, I do. I think it's uneven, though. I think that one thing across the sector is that I'd say museums are generally, because of their histories, much more familiar with playing that interpretive role, more comfortable with that. So they often do place curators and collection managers and conservators up front in terms of that process. Mm. I think particularly with libraries and to an extent archives, what we put forward generally is the material itself and kind of place ourselves behind. So it's more about researcher access and it's less about ourselves as interpreter. And so that does create a bit of an interesting difference, I think, in terms of the approach. But I think, you know, it is shifting, it is changing. And I think a lot of institutions are certainly trying to provide different online forums, talks and panels and, you know, Q&As and a lot of different, you know, sorts of digital media and seeing that it isn't that complex and you can be that person providing interpretation as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Nick. I 100% agree with you. I think, you know, the more we kind of open up those back of house areas and sort of show that it's not always the curators, it's not always collection managers, there's like a whole array of people that work to make these organizations tick. I just find it fascinating.
Yeah, they just don't realize, you know, they kind of see that the thing of, say, collecting a record or collecting, you know, a film is the same as, or, you know, presenting a film would be the same as preserving it in an archive, you know. A lot of people are critical looking at, say, digitization, preservation, digitization of material as opposed to full restoration, and don't quite see or understand what the role of an archive is in that context. And that is our responsibility to also communicate. But it is something which can be quite hard to understand, you know, why we keep particular types of film at 4 degrees versus 16 or whatever. Describing the importance and how that flows through all of our work is still really key.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's very technical aspects that are, and also just explaining, you know, to someone who has never come across an archivist, for example, before, just, you know, what is an archivist and what do they do? And archivists do lots of different things and lots of different collections. So it's such a complex area. But I feel like, you know, I think people understand, they might understand more, you know, in the way what a librarian does, or, you know, there's been that connection over many, but then there's a stereotype of what a librarian is, and that's changing as well. So yeah, it seems like it's a lengthy process, but it feels like this generation of glam workers are trying to shift that. Do you feel like that? There's a bit of a movement of a change happening there?
Oh, look, absolutely. You know, I guess one of my first jobs in the sector, I'd done an internship at the National Gallery back in 2000. But I was one of the first two graduates that the National Library ever had, which I think was 2002. So at the time, they'd had a cadet program, which I think was back in the 60s and 70s or earlier even, but they hadn't had a grad program. And it was a real shift, I think, for the institution, despite its sort of, you know, leading role in the sector, that they didn't really understand and the sorts of pathways and processes that they had in place for younger professionals moving in wasn't very clear, and how that can work in the organisation. And I think, you know, that's one example, but, you know, I think it is in a lot of senses looking at the ways to do generational change within cultural institutions where, you know, people generally stay much, much longer. You know, I when I came to the National Film and Sound Archive in the Melbourne office, I think the person in the office with the, you know, least amount of time at the organisation was 20 years. And, you know, that was an office at that time of 10 people. So, you know, people staying in their roles and, you know, that turnover is quite slow. So it is really strange to go into organisations, I think, as younger professionals, albeit that I think I'm much more middle-aged now, but being in a situation to affect that change as well.
Definitely. Like, I guess, you know, taking a step back, do you hope that there's going to be, you know, more inclusivity, you know, more diversity in our profession, in, if we talk about archives or museums, sort of professionals, and in glam generally? Do you think, I mean, it's something that constantly gets sort of raised as a, you know, there needs to be more cadetships and needs to be more mentorships and more opportunities for younger people and people from different backgrounds to encourage them into our profession, just to get different voices in there. Do you think that's something, I mean, it feels like it's slowly happening. It's such a slow process. It feels like everything's a slow process with these sorts of institutions, like you said, that have decades of, you know, there's history and there's people that stay in the organisations for decades upon decades. What do you think? Do you have any kind of positive view of it changing?
Yeah, no, absolutely, 100%. I think it is exciting. I think it's very, very slow. There needs to be much more proactive work undertaken, and it needs to be across the board. I think for a lot of institutions in the cultural sector, we've made some really great strides at really working on particularly involvement, engagement, empowerment even, and embedding processes around Indigenous and First Nations. The same principles aren't often applied in a broader sense. You know, if we're looking at this kind of beyond community consultation through to community empowerment and what communities that we want to highlight, it's, you know, often it ends up being a very narrow sort of concept of diversity. And, you know, one of the things I'm really excited by at the moment with the National Film and Sound Archive and our engagement team is that we've really highlighted our need to diversify our voices by engaging external people to write about the collection. But at the same time, you know, we've lost our single First Nations staff member who's moved on to a wonderful role. And they're going through a hiring process again, but, you know, looking at how, you know, where is that diversity elsewhere? You know, where is that diversity in disability in terms of migrant voices, in terms of, you know, asylum seeker or others? Are we doing disability? You know, it's not a tick box. It needs to be a process of empowerment. And in the same way with the queer LGBTI material, you know, I'm really grateful that there is, along with myself, many queer people at the National Film and Sound Archive. But often when I do that work as a volunteer through the queer archives and I work with institutions and, you know, I've worked with, you know, National Museum and Portrait Gallery, so many institutions and other media organisations, and some are incredibly poor with their process and incredibly rude and insulting. I won't work with them. But others are really wonderful and they're doing fantastic work. They take the time, they value, and you do feel like both your knowledge, the collections, the material, the stories and community are empowered as opposed to some sort of token process. So, yeah, that's really exciting, but it's just way too slow.
Gosh, I 100% agree with you. I think the thing that encourages me is when I see the young professionals coming through and just their ideas, and I you know, follow them on Twitter and things like that. Sometimes I get to meet them in person. It's great. Especially through New Cardigan, you get to meet so many amazing people. It gives me hope. It just, you know, I know it's a long process, but just have to live in a bit of hope that, you know, these young people coming, emerging, will change and shift our industry, and, you know, hopefully in 5-10 years time we'll be looking at a whole different industry. That's just what I'm hoping for. But you're right, we have to be proactive about it. We can't just hope for the best. We have to.
And, you know, look, a lot of the senior staff that are in there at the moment, I'd say, is particularly in the art museum, art gallery sector, you know, many of them who are in senior management came in at very young ages and have been for very long periods of time. And they're just the sorts of, you know, I've been told throughout most of my career, oh, no, do your time, keep your head down, you know, don't make waves. And, you know, often it's this incredibly frustrating situation where you try to provide that input, engagement, you try to shift that discussion, and you're just told to keep quiet. And, you know, they're, you know, looking at different ways to disrupt and to shift that. I think is can be very hard, and I think it is really exciting that people are coming in, but sometimes it needs to be a bit of a different process to try to shift that more dramatically.
That's right. I think I've seen this recently that with, you know, strategic planning happening in large organisations, if there's an appetite for, you know, really changing the culture within the organisation, it helps people that are agitating at the kind of grassroots level within the, you know, the workers doing the, who have probably been saying these things for years and years and kind of feel like they're hitting their head against a brick wall. But once the strategy comes in, like once, you know, it's coming from the exec level and they're starting to say, look, we want to make a change. We know we're not doing it right. We can see that we need to change to stay so that, you know, the community and the people that come visit these institutions can relate to them. Like if they become so outdated, people are going to stop, you know, people notice things like online. They can see the cult, you know, the types of attitudes of an institution is pretty clear cut when you can see the way they present themselves online and all of that sort of thing. So I'm hopeful because I'm just seeing, I have seen some change happening, that this is sort of coming from a higher level where it really supports those young, you know, the younger or the emerging people coming in with. And they're the ones agitating. They still need to agitate. You still need to, you know, you still need a lot of voices agitating. But I think, you know, hopefully the, you know, our visitors, our members, people that come to these institutions, if they also help out by agitating and saying, look, I'm a member, but this is what I want to see.
Or, you know, the other day I you know, occasionally I have a bit of fun on social media and tell other institutions off, you know, my esteemed colleagues for not putting, you know, highlighting people but denying their history. You know, yes, that is lesbian art. She was very avowedly a lesbian, National Gallery of Australia. And you really should put it, given that it's the artist's partner who she did the portrait of. Yeah, I mean, there's always those moments. And, you know, that even in that context, you know, there can be disconnects. And it's, you know, it always got to agitate.
Always got to call it out when you see it. Like, I think that's great that you do that, you know. And I wonder, do you think having the years of experience, you know, being at this stage in your career, do you find it easier to to call it out and feel like you've got a bit of support maybe from your co-workers, your manager, you know, do you have that support at work, do you think?
Yeah, look, it's interesting actually. Like we've recently been having some really fascinating discussions on things like how we document gender and how we've done that over time and why we need to and how we can look at name changes for various purposes in our catalogue and what sort of procedures. And it's been really interesting to look at aspects like how and do we want to include particular things. Like if we're looking at non-binary or, you know, gender fluid, other terms, that may be important to the person, but if we haven't always documented gender through the collection in terms of name authorities, is it then, you know, what is the step forward? And just interesting discussions. And you know, I think as an organisation, there's been a lot of openness to that sort of discussion and to questioning some of those systems. I think, you know, certainly within my own organisation, there's respect for the knowledge, which I've largely formed outside as a volunteer, but can be utilised and within my professional work as well, which is great. I think I went a bit off topic there, sorry.
No, you didn't. No, perfect. No, exactly. No, this is the sort of thing that I'm really interested in. I love that the fact that both your roles, like your volunteer role and your role at NFSA, there's cross-pollination, like you're learning from, you know, they're probably informing each other, which is, you know, I feel like that's part of our profession. I feel like volunteering is a big part. You know, I do a lot of, you know, New Cardigan, like, you know, like yourself, I volunteer as well for New Cardigan, Australian Society of Archivists and things. And I find like it's a really, I really value this part of our profession. I think we have to be careful not to exploit people in volunteering, but I also think we're such a giving profession. Like we want to give back into our community. You know, I think that's a really positive part of what we do. So kind of it's a love, maybe a nice way to end there, but I just wanted to say thank you so much, Nick, for speaking to me today online. And, you know, and sometimes it's better to do these interviews in person, but thank you so much while we're in lockdown speaking to me online. And I'd just like to say to our listeners, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy this interview. Keep an eye out. We'll have some Cardicast episodes coming and visit our website, newcardigan.org. But before we go, Nick, is there anywhere, are you on Twitter and things like that? Is there anywhere people can find you online, or could they just Google Nick Henderson and find, you know, your articles and things like that?
Yeah, no, my approach to doing kind of the communication and public history, I don't do much of myself in a sense. So I share on my own personal profile on Facebook. I manage the Australian Queer Archives Facebook page and group, and share into a range of groups, but I don't really have a public profile in that sense.
Yeah.
So you can't find me anywhere unless you go onto those two. So if you, that's, it's really more on queer history side. Jump online.
Jump online, find Australian Queer Archives on Twitter and on Facebook. But also I noticed when I sort of did a bit of a Google and found that you've got, I think, some blogs attached to your name on the National Film and Sound Archives website as well, that you might want to, if you want to have a read there, listeners. So thanks a million, Nick. It's really been great talking to you today. And hopefully we can see each other in real life soon, maybe in the next Cardi Party, probably sometime down the track.